This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Rebecca Rigo Barry about her book that's just come out in early 2024 when we're speaking, titled The Vanishing of Carolyn Wells, Investigations into a Forgotten Mystery Author, which is a really interesting kind of combined book in a way that is more than I think the sum of its parts. In the one sense, this is a biography of Carolyn Wells, who turns out to be really interesting. On the other hand, it's also an exploration, an explanation of why we don't actually know very much about her, when actually her life suggests that maybe we should. So Rebecca, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to unveil these mysteries to us.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yeah. Well, for most of my career so far, I've been a journalist. So in a large chunk of that 13 years, I spent as editor of a magazine called Fine Books and Collections, which is a quarterly magazine here in the States that's for rare book collectors, librarians, curators, people who are interested in rare and antiquarian books and documents. And in the course of that, I would find myself very often at these big antiquarian book fairs. And one year, 2011, my husband actually bought me a book as a gift at one of these book fairs and brought it home. And a few weeks later, I opened it and it had in it a book plate, actually two book plates. And one of them is a book plate of Carolyn Wells, who is not a name I had heard of at the time. And I mean, I was intrigued because it was kind of uncommon at the time in the early 20th century for women to have enough, you know, money or agency really to be their own book collector, you know, not to be part of a husband and wife team, but just to be her own book collector. And so her name kind of stuck with me. And then I started to see her name pop up as an author of mystery novels. I mean, it took 7-8 years really for this to really kind of click in my head and have this aha moment that this woman who was a book collector was also a mystery author. And then the more I started to look into her, the more I began to realize that she was not only a mystery author. She wrote in history, she wrote in humor, she wrote children's books and young adult books. In total, she wrote 182 books. And yet it was a name I had never heard of, even though I had studied literature in college and, you know, I'm an inveterate reader. So I really couldn't understand the disconnect. And and just couldn't find a biography of her. I couldn't find an estate or an archive. And I thought, and this seems like a really good, like a true life detective story. I can do some research. And that's really where it started. Just wanting to find out more about her and wondering why it is I didn't know her name.
Hmm.
What a great sort of intriguing starting point. I'm definitely going to come back and ask you kind of more about that. Why don't we know about her? But I think in order to understand like why that's an important question to ask, we have to know a bit more about her first to understand kind of why it matters that we've forgotten her. So can you tell us a bit about what your investigation was able to find? Do we know things like when, where she was born, who her parents were, what her early life was like?
Yeah. So one of the first things I found out about her is from a Rahway, New Jersey public library. On their website, they had this little blurb about her. And the reason they had a little blurb about her is because she was a librarian, a town librarian for over a decade. But just to rewind a bit, she was born in June of 1862 in Rahway, New Jersey, which is kind of a central New Jersey suburb, kind of somewhere between Philadelphia and New York, kind of in the middle there. And she was born into a pretty middle class, maybe upper middle class, prosperous family, some privilege, certainly, but not without hardships. In fact, she lost her older brother and her younger sister, both in childhood. And when her younger sister died of scarlet fever, she actually had contracted it as well and lost hearing in one ear, which is something that troubled her for the rest of her life. But so there were some hardships and actually turned her into a bit of a stoic person, as much as she liked to project herself as this witty, whimsical, humorous author. But she did not grow up in a bookish household. In fact, her father really limited her reading. And it wasn't until she discovered the public library in town and knew that she could just walk somewhere and pick any book she wanted to, that she really began to blossom as a reader. Previous to that, she had been more of a kid who was into collecting and puzzles. That was one of the big things that they did as a family, puzzles, which will come up later in her life. But it was definitely a traditional upbringing. Whatever you might think of when you think of sort of the, you know, late Civil War, early Gilded Age America, sort of upper middle class, you know, those kinds of norms for her gender and her class at the time, that's the kind of lifestyle she would have followed. I mean, there was social life, there was church activities, and she was educated, but decided not to go to college, instead deciding to craft her own scholarly development by studying French, German, history, botany, Shakespeare, and basically just created her own education. That's pretty much what her early life was like.
So obviously that kind of amount of interest in reading and learning may not be entirely typical in the ways that kind of the other aspects of her life do sound kind of very sort of straightforward, what we might expect. We wouldn't necessarily expect that women with that sort of background would become published authors. Mm-hmm. So when does that happen? When does she start to publish? Why does she start to publish? What sorts of things is she publishing and for what kinds of publications?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, once she's into her 20s and even late 20s, really, she's not doing all that much with her life. She, like I said, had decided not to go to college. Jobs at the time, it would have been a tricky thing for her to be employed, considering her class. There was some strange feelings about women working outside of the home. She was not yet married, and so she kind of finds herself, you know, getting closer to 30 and not really having any employment in her life. And she takes a job as a town librarian. And I guess it's probably considered enough of a genteel position that it was okay for her to do this. She was still living at home, with her parents at the time. And, you know, in that job, she basically describes how she would just read all day, which sounds just phenomenal. But and in the course of reading all day, she discovered what were known as little magazines, these kind of artsy, progressive journals that kind of sprung up in the 1890s in the shadow of, you know, the bigger mainstream magazines. And they published a lot of, you know, poetry and prose. And she just must have considered that she was good at doing that as well, like wordplay and prose, and started pitching the editors of these little magazines. And little by little got accepted, you know, and started seeing her words in print. And she kind of took every small success, you know, every tiny magazine, and turned it into the next success. And, you know, within the course of just a few years, really from the mid 1890s to the turn of the century, she goes from being an absolute literary nobody to, you know, publishing in Life magazine and Saturday Evening Post and having, you know, several books just in a row come out and go from, you know, it, you know, keeps her day job during all of this because it's not quite certain that she can be an author, but just starts writing and is writing, you know, not only in poetry, but it starts writing for children and starts writing young adult novels.
That's a really interesting sort of transition and already some hints of like multiple different kinds of writing or genres going on, which she really seems to kind of keep going to quite an impressive degree. So I don't think there's really a way that I could ask about all of the different genres she writes in one question. So I'm going to try and break it up a little bit. But can you sort of compare and contrast with us, I suppose, her publishing in humor and her publishing in young adult literature? Because as I understand it, these are kind of happening and growing very much sort of at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's doing the first decade that she finally, you know, once she finally is published and starts making these connections with all these editors, it's like she just absolutely takes off. And the first 5 or 10 years, she is just like a machine in terms of how much she can write. Like, she's very productive and very prolific. And I think it has something to do, at least in the beginning, humor and children's, that it has something to do with the fact that they're really the same forms that she's writing in, poems, short prose, wordplay, what she called nonsense. and it's really, it's in the vein of Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear. And so, you know, it's, so what I mean by that is that it's the kind of work that, you know, you say, oh, well, this is for children, right? But is it for children? It's not. It could be for anybody, really. It's charming and amusing and just beloved. And, you know, some of it goes into these children's magazines, specifically one called St. Nicholas, which was published by Scribner, and it was kind of considered a literary magazine for children. And then sometimes the poems show up in, you know, Life magazine or the Saturday Evening Post or Harper's. And it's just weird that there is not very much of a line between those two things, that she's just, some of them end up in the children's magazines and some of them end up in the quote unquote adult magazines.
Which is definitely interesting given how sort of distinct we might see them today.
Yeah.
Were they received differently? I mean, I imagine they must have been, but what kinds of responses did she get for her writing?
Well, she actually ended up writing for children's magazines like St. Nicholas and the Youth's Companion for, I mean, over a decade. She was just kind of a standby, you know, in the magazine every week. And even in these other magazines, I mean, her name was everywhere. I mean, you know, when I started kind of looking into her and researching and going into all these digital databases and plugging her name in, you know, what would come back to me was 2,000 citations from, you know, this group of magazines. And it was really quite fun to go through them, but you know, you look at it and it's just a daunting mountain of material. But at the time, you know, say around 1910, 1911, actually Life magazine in 1911 called her the shining exception to the villainous statement that women have no sense of humor. This is kind of a trope at the time. And actually, even now in the 21st century, right, this idea, like, are women funny, was something that came up during her lifetime. And she was actually held out as, you know, the funny woman. You know, there would be magazine articles that would, you know, be like the top 10 funniest people in America, top 10 humor writers in America. And 9 of them would be male. And 1 of them would be Carolyn. And so she was really seen at this time as just like, you know, very funny, witty, almost like a Dorothy Parker before Dorothy Parker came along.
Interesting to think of those sorts of lists of the nine and then the one.
Yeah.
Especially as you talk about in the book, there's a lot of ways in which she's helping shape these genres kind of as they're in the process of developing. Could you talk maybe particularly about her influence on the genre of, I guess, what we call now sort of young adult fiction?
Yeah, I mean, that genre was really reinventing itself at the turn of the century. And, you know, I don't know how familiar people are with this thing called the Stratemeyer Syndicate, which is something that gets underway around 1905. And it's kind of a fiction factory. They start putting out books under the imprints like the Bobsey Twins and the Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. And these are all kind of constructed by a publishing house and written by sort of ghostwriters and published in serial novels that are, you know, pumped out and being sold to teens and tweens. And they don't have the best reputation, at least among librarians at the time, because they're seen as kind of too easy, you know, easy reading. And that's not going to do any good for the youth to be coddled so much. But Carolyn, when she was writing at the same time, not only did she see the market for girls, for like fiction for girls, there just wasn't a lot out there for girls. But she also knew enough or was savvy enough to realize that she had to make these books wholesome. There had to be a moral. And she does that and does it in such a way that the children don't quite know that they're reading moralistic literature, but the parents are happy enough with it that, you know, it's wholesome enough. And there's actually some scholarship around her children's and young adult novels that say that, you know, until this time, Louisa May Alcott was really the only author for children that was deemed okay, deemed good reading for children, for especially for girls, until Carolyn Wells came along. So she really ended up filling this niche and then just was able to parlay that into several different series and became really beloved. I mean, for example, her Patty books, she had this series of 17 Patty books. And, you know, in examining them, I was able to examine lots of copies online and in digital libraries. And what I found about them is that so many of them have these really wonderful inscriptions from mother to daughter or grandmother to granddaughter. They were kind of almost like heirloom quality books where, you know, parents, mothers, grandmothers, aunts felt really good about, you know, giving this kind of material to their daughters. And that is the niche that she filled at the time.
That's a lovely sort of tradition to get to see. I was sort of surprised, having kind of read up to this point and just being still quite shocked by like how much she's writing. and like people love it. Like it's not like she's writing stuff that's not great, right? And yet then you go on to talk about all the things she's doing in the literary world besides writing. And I'm like, hang on, how did she have time or energy for this? What was she up to besides sitting and writing all these books?
I mean, by 1902, which she's been a librarian at that point for 12 years, that's the year that she leaves her job as a librarian and really kind of strikes out as, you know, just a full-time author. So, and she, you know, at the time is still living at home, I mentioned, you know, with her parents, because that's kind of what would have been expected of her. Not married, obviously doesn't have children. So yeah, I mean, she does have a lot of time on her hands, which she is filling by writing. And although when she's interviewed at the time, she's very cagey about the fact that she doesn't work too hard. I guess that was maybe, that didn't look good if she was out there working too hard. So she's very much out there saying things like, well, I only work 3 days a week and only for 3 hours at a time. And, you know, just that it came very easily to her. I mean, maybe that's true, but I don't know how someone could produce this much material working only 9 or 12 hours a week. And not only that, you know, later on, maybe in the next decade or so, she becomes involved with, she becomes a founding member of the Authors League, which is now called the Authors Guild, to make sure that authors are getting, you know, the rights for their material is being upheld. She joins a bunch of little theater groups, a detective story club, which is kind of like a book of the month club, but for crime and detective fiction that gets started here in the United States in the 1920s. She's writing for a magazine called The Bookman. I mean, she's writing for many magazines, literally dozens of magazines all at the same time. But there's one magazine called The Bookman that she, I mean, it's like she's on staff. She's writing in nearly every issue of it. She becomes later on the editor of the First American Mystery Stories series, which is still a series that is published annually today. So yeah, I mean, she's just got just so much going on. And another thing about her in the midst of all this is that she doesn't have an agent. She's very often, she spends a lot of time on correspondence where she's writing to editors directly, trying to sell her serial rights or following up on payments, or, you know, asking when is the reprint going to come out. You know, she's the one doing that, whereas today those are the kinds of things that we tend to think agents are handling for authors. She was doing that as well.
That is just so incredibly much. And I particularly appreciated that kind of last point of her being a literary, her own agent. You talk about in the book, you have some great examples of kind of the fact she tries to sort of hide that, or is that right? She tries to kind of pretend she isn't her own agent?
She does sometimes say she has an agent. I've never found any evidence of that. But what one of the things I do like about her, even, you know, early in her career, well, she would write to these, you know, somewhat famous editors of magazines, you know, editors of, say, Life magazine or Saturday Evening Post, and you know, offer a poem or offer a piece of work and then say, well, I need you to let me know immediately if you don't want it because I have 10 other editors I can send it to. You know, she was just very upfront and just, I don't know, tenacious, just would really put lay it all on the table and be happy to walk away if she had to.
Fair enough. And clearly it worked for her.
Yeah. Yeah. Surprising.
So given what you've told us so far, kind of the number of genres she's writing in, the number of different publications, all of this additional stuff she's doing, she adds more to this as she goes along. When and why did she start to write mystery novels? And why do you think that this aspect of her career, despite all the other successes you've told us about so far, was actually the most lucrative?
Well, she, during the 1890s, when Arthur Conan Doyle was, you know, so becoming so famous for her Sherlock Holmes stories, I mean, she's a reader. She's obviously reading them. She loves his work. She also loves the work of Anna Katharine Green, who's considered the, you know, mother of American detective fiction. So those things are obviously on her mind in the 1890s or late 1890s, her love of detective fiction. And I guess at some point, you know, I think she writes in her memoir, somebody was reading to her an Anna Katharine Green novel, and she kind of just got it into her head that, you know what, I can do that. And she did. I mean, she just, sort of like anything else she worked on, she just kind of, but whatever work someone put in front of her, she could just do it. If a publisher said, I want you to write a book about X, she could just somehow turn it out. But she turns her attention to detective fiction. She publishes her first story in 1905 and her first actual full-length detective novel in 1909. And I actually think it had a lot to do with her childhood love of puzzles. You know, she, like I was mentioning before, how her family was very into puzzles and word games. And that's something that she brought along through her poetry, into her writing for children. And then, you know, kind of parlays all of that into mysteries as well. And the idea that, like, a mystery novel at its core is a puzzle with a bunch of clues that are left behind and you have to put it all together. So that's how she gets started writing mysteries. And, you know, at the time, there were not that many women writing detective novels. So maybe I don't think that was, I don't think that helped her any, because there are certainly critics who thought women should not be writing detective novels. But the genre itself was definitely on the rise. So she was kind of getting in on the ground floor, so to speak. And she had publishers who loved her. She had readers who adored her. She had already made a name for herself as a humor writer, and with some other novels that she wrote, some sort of, you know, parody novels, and even some, a couple of adult novels that were not mystery novels. So she had already built up this name for herself by the time her first mystery novel comes out in 1909. I mean, she's basically a household name. So I think she really had an audience ready to go. And since the genre itself was already on the rise, it just seemed like everything was coming together for her at that moment. And, you know, I like to point out when I'm talking about this, you know, her first mystery novel, she was 47 when she published her first mystery novel. And that to me is really quite amazing, because in her time, 47 would have been just ancient. And to realize that she published the first of 82 mystery novels at the age of 47, and that she, you know, just would go for it at that time, I find that really inspiring.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, especially in a time when, as you said, there were so few women writing mystery novels, no matter their age, right? To add that aspect as well. Can we kind of talk about sort of all these things coming together in this credibly sort of successful time that leads to even expansion? I mean, somehow, how did she find the time and energy? But expansion beyond writing all of this. What were the 1920s like for Carolyn?
Yeah, the 1920s. Well, just to back up a tiny bit, she published one of her biggest bestsellers in 1918, a book called Vicky Van, and which was actually adapted into a film as well. And she got married at the age of 55. She actually got married and moved from New Jersey, from her parents' home where she had still been living, to New York City, and she kind of, you know, so her life really vastly changes in 1918, you know. She moves to New York City and is then able to sort of meld more easily with the social life and the literary life of New York City. However, her husband actually dies very soon after they're married, about 16 months after they're married. So then, you know, she doesn't have him, but she does have this big apartment in New York City and this new lifestyle that she's created. So the 1920s for her, it's probably a mixture of good and bad, but she does continue writing her mysteries. In fact, in the 20s, she really ramps up her production. She's no longer writing any of, she does turn up in magazines here and there, still with poems here and there, but she's no longer writing any for children's or her young adult or anything else. She's focused entirely on mysteries, and she's writing 3-4 what, sometimes 5 mysteries a year. So that's really how she spends the 1920s. And also, to, you know, bring in another tangent, she actually starts book collecting as well. And this is kind of ties into that, what I was saying at the beginning about finding her book plate in a rare book. The 1920s, as a sort of a distraction from being sad over her husband dying, some friends swoop in and say, well, maybe you ought to try, you know, setting your eyes on book collecting, which is, you know, another thing she can take on while she's writing 3, 4, or 5 novels a year.
So would you, you know, tell us a bit more about the book collecting? Is that kind of one of her big legacies, given that, I mean, it obviously lasted enough that you found evidence of it yourself. If we kind of put all these things together and think about it from a legacy perspective, what sort of jumps out at you?
Yeah, I do think that the collecting is one of her legacies, and particularly in that she collected Walt Whitman, rare editions of Walt Whitman. And when she died, she left quite an incredible collection to the Library of Congress, which her collection is still there now at the Library of Congress. So just in terms of that collection alone, not even to talk about all the rest of her books that are out there floating in various collectors and various university and college libraries, but the Walt Whitman collection alone that she was able to secure. I think there's 100 editions of Leaves of Grass. There are quite some very, really special editions that the Library of Congress now owns because of her. So that's certainly one of her legacies. Another one, which I haven't talked about at all, is a nonfiction book that she published in 1913 called The Technique of the Mystery Story, which was really the first history of that genre. And a little bit too of a how-to for writers. You know, if you want to get into mystery writing, this is how you might do it. But it really codified the genre and the quote-unquote rules of the game, as, you know, some mystery authors and readers like to talk about, you know, the rules, the ground rules for a good mystery. So that's something that she doesn't necessarily get credit for either, is that, you know, writing this first history of the genre. And the Patty books, as I mentioned before, in terms of her young adult books, I think they have a pretty long legacy. I've actually heard from readers, you know, middle-aged and older readers of these Patty books, because, you know, they were printed in 1901 to 1919, but they were reprinted as late as the 1940s. And so you have people today who remember reading them as children, either passed down from their mothers, or, you know, they bought reprints as children in the 1940s. It just having a lasting effect on these readers as children. So I think that's another one of her legacies. It's probably, it's not quite as overt, but it's definitely something that she had this great effect on readers. And that's, to me, that's an interesting point, both in the young adult section and also in the mysteries, because, you know, you talk about whether or not critics liked her work. And this is a question that comes up, obviously, and that later critics began not to critics in like 30s, 40s, and then even after her death, when she's gone and they're writing about her, you know, would disparage certain elements of her mystery writing. I don't know. I think that you can't argue with the fact of great sales and librarians carrying your work and being one of the top checked out fiction authors of the 1930s. I mean, you can't argue with the fact that she had a readership, a huge audience that really enjoyed her work.
So this then brings us back to the question right at the beginning, that I think we now very much have the context to kind of understand just how perplexing it is. Given that, especially if we're talking kind of the 1930s, which is not that long ago, and sort of that amount of readership and impact, why don't we know her now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it kind of comes down to probably three or four main points. One of them, you know, I talked a little bit about before, that when she started out as a mystery author, and even when she was a humor author, and there was a certain amount of misogyny going on in the time. So, like I said, if she was listed in terms of, the 10 humor writers that are so popular in America, and she's the one woman in the group, this happened again when she was a mystery author, actually. There would be lists of 10, 12, 15 mystery authors, and she would be there. There would sometimes be a second woman there, Mary Roberts Rinehart, who is kind of her closest competitor in the mystery market in America. So there's a certain amount of misogyny. In fact, one of the reviews of her book, one of her books from 1916, I have a quote here because I use it when I'm talking about this very thing. The critic said, "Detective stories written by women do not, as a rule, promise much in the way of entertainment. They set at defiance every known law of reason and play havoc with the reader's credibility," which I just find so amusing. He actually said that, and then he turned it around and said, "But Carolyn Wells is different. She's actually a good writer." But it's funny that's, you know, was kind of a given that you know, women couldn't write mystery novels, and how that would be turned around, frankly, in the next few decades. I think another thing that's happening for Carolyn is that she's writing in these genres that are, you know, they were just less valued than they are today, particularly young adult and mysteries. Today, we don't really see them as too different in the sort of ecosystem of literary fiction or just literature in general. But there's always been that sort of highbrow versus lowbrow, literary versus genre question out there. And for many decades, to say you were writing as a young adult fiction or you're just writing mysteries, like it was very much considered like less than if you were writing literary books. And maybe you aren't worth remembering if you're just you're writing young adult and mystery novels. So I think that's certainly a factor. But I think the biggest factor for Carolyn, and for which she needs to share some of the blame, is that she didn't plan necessarily for her estate. So she didn't put into place a literary executor or set up an estate. So when she died in 1942, the Walt Whitman collection did in fact go to the Library of Congress, thankfully. But everything else was left to her maid, a woman, a companion, a woman who had taken care of her for the last two decades of her life. And unfortunately, it just was not a person who was capable or interested in keeping Carolyn's name, you know, in the public eye and, you know, or going to publishers and saying, well, why aren't you reprinting her books? Or, you know, this is exactly when the huge paperback boom is happening, you know, during the war. And, you know, her books would have been, or especially her mysteries would have been perfect in that format. You know, paperback format, 25-cent detective novels, they were everywhere. And she theoretically should have been part of that paperback boom, but she wasn't. And it's because there was no one advocating for her. So that, I think, was the biggest issue, because once you're no longer in the bookshops and once the libraries weed your books out, you know, maybe 10 years or 15 years after you've died and there's nothing else coming out, then how do readers find you? Mm-hmm. And if critics don't keep you in the public eye or professors, it's very easy to just fade into obscurity.
Mm-hmm. So are any of her books still in print?
No. I mean, when you talk about books that, you know, remained in print this whole time for decades, no. There are a couple of books that have been reprinted. Murder in the Bookshop, which was a New York Times bestseller in 1936. And it's actually kind of popular. I wouldn't want to call it a cult classic, but it's pretty popular among book collectors because it's set in a rare bookshop and a rare book collector gets murdered in, you know, in the plot. But that a British imprint actually put out a copy, a reprint of that book in 2018, which is actually partially what got me started on researching Carolyn for real. But her first mystery, The Clue, a new audio edition has just been published. But a lot of the books at this point, I mean, the copyright would have to be researched on a base, you know, book-by-book basis, and because she left them to the maid and then they got handed down and then handed down, it's pretty unclear who actually owns the copyrights to any of the later novels. But the earlier work would all be in the public domain by now anyway, and so can be found in ebooks and some like audiobook editions read by AI narrators. But there's not very much out there in terms of, you know, in terms of books that you can walk into a bookshop and buy or mm-hmm. walk into a library and see it on a shelf and it's right there in your face.
If you could wave a magic wand and pick one to bring back to that level of visibility, which one would you pick and why?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a great question. But there's so many to choose from. And I almost wish, you know, I'd almost say as an answer to that I would love to see an edition of that actually hasn't never been published, but like of her collected poetry and prose, particularly those and parody, particularly those that had to do with bookish topics, authors, publishing. She published a lot on these issues or on these subjects, and, you know, very lighthearted, but sometimes it's an undercurrent of some like vicious thoughts about the publishing industry and fellow authors. And I actually think that an edition of that poetry and prose would be really cool, really interesting. I'd actually love to edit something like that. But I also think there's another one of her mystery novels called Vicky Van. I think I mentioned it before, from 1918, that a few scholars have pointed out recently. It's really considered like one of her quintessential mystery novels, and kind of fits really, really well into the time period. The mystery novel as a whole kind of undergoes this evolution, you know, during the war, you know, between the two wars, and even, you know, a little bit after. And Carolyn doesn't quite keep up. You know, she's still kind of writing the kinds of detective novels that she started out writing in 1909, 1910. Even when we're into the 1930s and early 1940s, she's kind of still writing the same type of book, which while the rest of the genre and the rest of the authors maybe kind of started evolving in a different direction toward more characterization and more thoughts about motivation of characters, she kind of kept doing what she had always been doing. And this is maybe why later critics are critical of that, that they start to see her as old fashioned, which, you know, I can certainly see that.
Fair enough, but definitely some intriguing possibilities there.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you'd love to edit a collection of her sort of parody and prose. I assume that's probably, however, not what you're working on next. Is there anything you're working on now that you've sort of investigated this mystery?
No, you know, I would like to do another biography. I've actually really enjoyed the process. I love the research process as a whole. But, you know, publishers, agents, they are sadly wary of taking risks on subjects like Carolyn Wells, that is to say, unknown people. No matter how famous they were in their time, they're unknown to us today. And so that's a hard sell. But I am more partial to working on a story like that than to work on, like, you know, the 10th biography of Emily Dickinson, unless there's some kind of groundbreaking information that's out there now. I would love to broaden the scope. And that's the kind of work I would like to do. Whether or not agents and publishers are on board to do that kind of work, is a question.
Fair enough. Well, while you look for that next project, hopefully another kind of interesting person to revive back into our consciousness, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled The Vanishing of Carolyn Wells, Investigations into a Forgotten Mystery Author. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.